Welcome to a DerivSource podcast on the cost of clearing. In this DerivSource podcast, we have two derivatives experts who will be discussing the cost of central clearing of OTC derivatives contracts. We'll be discussing connectivity, collateral management, and operational costs that financial institutions must manage in order to meet this regulatory requirement and also the G20 commitment. Now on the panel today, we have Professor Craig Perrong, who is a professor of finance and energy markets, director for the Global Energy Management Institution at Bauer College of Business and the University of Houston. Mr. Perrong will be offering some insight from his paper on the economics of central clearing theory and practice. We also have Ed Allen, who is the director of EMEA OTC Clearing at Bank of America Merrill Lynch. He will be offering his insight into the cost of clearing for banks and for the clients of client clearing solutions for OTC derivatives. Now, I'd like to start the conversation today with a conversation about connectivity and looking at the cost of connectivity to the multiple CCPs on a regional as well as a global basis. And Ed, as an expert in this area, would you like to start us off with some of the issues that you see in connectivity and the cost of this?
Sure. So I think with respect to connectivity, there are a few things to bear in mind. The first thing is that many of the larger financial institutions are already connected to clearinghouses today, and you know there are a range of providers, generally split up by asset class. So you'll see clearinghouses that provide clearing in CDS and interest rates, and in some cases they're independent of one another. In different markets, we have different clearing platforms that are in operation. And in limited circumstances, some clearinghouses are offering, let's say, global solutions. However, there are a couple of really important points that create additional costs, and those costs being driven by the either financial, operational, or simply project costs for all financial end users of derivatives to access central clearing solutions. The first of those is that I suggested that many large financial institutions are already members of clearinghouses. But of course, there are many financial institutions that will neither want to be nor have the capacity to be a member of a clearinghouse. And for that reason, they will need to access the clearinghouse through a third-party provider, generally one of the larger financial institutions like Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, amongst several others. And that, of course, means that they will have to establish relationships through that provider of clearing services, generally based on legal agreements, which, although approaching some kind of market standard in the US, we still have a degree of legal work that will be required for an end user to understand how to actually access the clearinghouse through a clearing broker. I think the other question in terms of connectivity is, how do I get my trade into that clearinghouse? And there, I think there has been some really good progress in the last 12 months, some of which has been driven by regulators, but generally speaking, the connectivity is via an electronic medium. The trades for the clearinghouse to accept them through the day that the trade is done would need to be formed electronically between an executing broker and the derivative counterparty that wants the trade to be cleared. And the other issue that you face, of course, is that then the trade to be cleared would need to go through the clearing broker with the same system. I said that there's been some positive moves in that sense, and really those are all driven by the fact that clearinghouses are trying to open themselves up to provide open access, which is one of the tenets of the regulation in both the US and the proposed regulation that we see in Europe, which is under debate at the moment. So that would mean that if a client or a clearing member was using a particular platform to book their trades and clear them, the clearinghouse should be agnostic as to where the source of that information might come from. But all of this, of course, means that clients that are being required to clear OTC derivatives on a mandatory basis will have to take into account some of these challenges when establishing the relationship. So those would probably be sort of two or three of the areas that I would highlight at the moment that really sort of create some of the work for the market as a whole to access central clearing for OTC products.
Excellent. And Craig, is there something you'd like to add on connectivity?
Well, I think Ed did a very good and thorough job. But one sort of way of characterizing what he said is that this creates an opportunity for intermediaries, the Merrills, the J.P. Morgans, et cetera, to essentially serve as an interface with multiple clearinghouses and essentially serve as the interconnecting nodes for customers. And so it's going to reconfigure the financial network in interesting ways.
Okay, fantastic. Now let's move on to margin management, because this is the biggest cost or that financial institutions that will have to deal with in central clearing. Obviously, margin eligibility, initial margin requirement, which is new to traditional asset managers, is going to be something of a cost that people have to deal with. Now, Craig, you've done this paper, The Economics of Central Clearing Theory and Practice, and margin management was a big part of this. Can you talk us through some of the biggest concerns for cost in margin management going forward?
Right. I mean, this is sort of a first order issue that has sort of ramifications not just at the user level, at the intermediary level, but it also has implications in terms of market stability and systemic risk, which is supposedly the whole reason for moving to clearing mandates. So essentially, a lot of people who heretofore have not been required to post margin are going to be required to post margin. And if they're trading in a variety of instruments and they that are cleared through a variety of clearinghouses, we could be talking about substantial sums of capital being tied up in margin. And so I think that there's going to be sort of tremendous pressure to try to find ways to economize on that. And all the potential ways, though, are going to require a lot of coordination among CCPs, and some of the issues that have been raised have been, for example, talking about cross margining across different clearinghouses. So if I have risk positions that are essentially offsetting or essentially essentially hedge one another, but they're in different clearinghouses, how can I essentially take advantage of that by some sort of cross margining arrangement where I can reduce the amount of margin to reflect the amount of overall risk that I bring into the system, as opposed to the risk associated with the individual legs of transactions. Other issues that are being talked about are in terms of essentially having clearinghouses interconnect. I think that that's likely to be a non-starter, because as one panelist, CEO of a clearinghouse, said in a panel that I was in London, that idea is, quote, crackers, unquote, because of the sort of reluctance of CCPs to sort of accept risk from other CCPs. Other issues involved with margin that will also affect cost, both directly and indirectly, is how that margin is going to be held. How is it going to be segregated? And that is going to have ramifications as well. And in light of today's news, literally, of the segregation issues at MF Global, I think that is also going to be brought back to the fore. So in terms of what's going to drive costs, this is going to be a very important issue. And there's also going to be, and this is going to sort of segue into the liquidity discussion that we are going to have in a bit, which is there's going to be a tremendous demand for liquidity in order to meet these sorts of increased collateral and margining needs. And so what kind of assets are going to be usable as collateral? What sort of services are big financial intermediaries going to offer their customers to try to essentially transform assets that can't be posted at CCPs directly as collateral, allow them to essentially transform those assets into resources that can be posted as collateral. I think also CCPs are going to be under tremendous pressure to expand the set of assets that they're willing to take as collateral, and that raises all sorts of risk issues. You just start pulling on this string, and it's just amazing all the issues that arise from this move to central clearing and the initial margin requirements associated with that.
And you mentioned collateral transformation, which is obviously a major added value service that the client clearing providers, the banks and broker dealers, are aiming to provide their buy side clients for a client or for their client clearing. Now, Ed, as someone who's actually built this client clearing solution for Bank of America Merrill Lynch, can you explain a little bit as to what you see the concerns are with margin management, how you can help as a bank that your clients cope?
Sure, sure. I mean, I think, you know, Craig's outlined some of the issues very well there. I think the one thing I would add, though, is, you know, the there's a differential requirement depending on the portfolio of derivatives that are being cleared. So, you know, the question for the client is not only what assets can I deliver, but obviously the level of margin. And this initial margin, when the clearinghouse is looking at a portfolio and risk of liquidation of that portfolio at time of market stress, we see very different outcomes for different types of end user. And ironically, I guess it's the, you know, generally we would see as being the lower probability of default end user, pension funds and so on, that may see the larger levels of margin requirement. And that's why in Europe at the moment there is a, you know, proposed exemption in the short term at least for pension funds under the regulations there in light of these additional costs. So I guess one of the things I'd, to respond to your question, Julia, I'd say is that, you know, we've tried to design solutions for clients that meet their needs, and the clients generally have quite differing requirements depending on what assets they hold today, what the levels of margin that they might face could be, the timing at which the payments would be required to the clearinghouse and likewise then the clearing broker. So there are a range of options there. Generally, though, the big question that really a lot of this drives, which Craig was talking about, is the risk that's involved. And obviously, for a client that's using an intermediary who's providing, let's say, some kind of asset transformation service, they need to understand exactly where the risk lies. And traditional repo, for example, is generally a user of balance sheet. So those providers that are going down that route will obviously need to have, you know, a very large and available balance sheet for providing this service, and that, you know, that's just a generally accepted fact. I think there are other solutions that are out there, but generally those solutions are going to involve custody type arrangements with other third parties, legal agreements that need to operate at a point of default of either the clearing member or the client that give both of those parties. And indeed, you know, the custodian as well, the rights over the assets that are held within that segregated account. So there's some complexities there for, you know, the clients to understand, and indeed there are some risks there for all parties, both the client and the clearing broker, in establishing these types of relationships. But what I would say is that, you know, we've recognized this issue from a very early stage and built some solutions that we think work, and, you know, depend upon, I think, the commitment of the business in terms of balance sheet to get those things to function effectively. That's how I would summarize it.
And I think, you know, we also should think about the, you know, sort of the systemic ramifications of this. I was speaking to a big industrial end user energy company risk manager, and he said that, you know, in many respects, what these clearing mandates have done is transformed a credit risk problem into a liquidity problem, and that he finds liquidity problems a lot scarier and more difficult to deal with. You know, also, you know, from a systemic perspective, sort of the whole idea about moving to clearing mandates was a concern about, you know, sort of too much leverage in the system through coming through the derivatives market. Well, people are just going to find alternative ways to, you know, generate that leverage. And so, in some respects, I think regulators have overestimated the systemic benefits of moving to these sorts of clearing solutions, and they might have result in the substitution of similarly fragile financing structures into the system.
Yeah, I think I'd come back on some of that there and say that, you know, the end users that are particularly affected at the moment are probably in a situation where there's a big, you know, a big move from their current financing arrangements around the management of counterparty risk to what they would face today. For example, you know, if the derivative is traded OTC and there's no exchange of collateral today, then obviously there's going to be a significant difference between the funding costs on those trades and the funding costs on the trades is clear. I guess one of the questions that needs to be addressed, though, is what's the implication then for the pricing of that trade? And one of the things that we're very keen to do is make sure that clients understand that they may be getting, whilst the risks have changed, that generates a different pricing of that risk, and consequently, the pricing of the swaps that they are putting on may become significantly altered as a result of central clearing. It seems strange, when this was first mooted, I guess in 2009. The regulators probably thought that they were doing something which was just a post-trade activity, but obviously changing the way that collateral moves on a swap over its lifetime will have significant implications for the cost of doing that trade. Ultimately, there may be some very big beneficiaries in the market, but as Craig points out, there are probably some people in the market that may not benefit from this based with how they do things today. I'll just add one final point, if I may, Julia, though. We're talking a lot about central clearing. There's obviously proposals in the US around OTC derivative markets that aren't cleared, and requirements around how what we term bilateral swaps will be dealt with from a collateral perspective on an ongoing basis, which would involve something akin to the initial margin that a central clearing counterparty would require being put into a segregated account. And likewise, all OTC derivatives being governed by a CSA agreement for the majority of financial market participants. Now, that is trying to almost, in some ways, as we see it, normalize the playing field between the costs of clearing and the cost of non-clearing a trade. So generally speaking, if we see, across both of those types of treatments of cleared and uncleared trades, we're going to see an increase in cost for most market participants when acting in the OTC markets. As I say, that may be offset by differences in pricing, but as yet, I don't think that those pricing differences would be very visible or being realized by many market participants.
Now, Ed, you brought up a very good point, and I before we move on to the operational cost and drilling down into that specifically, which you've already you both have alluded to. Now, the question of unintended risks or consequences with central clearing and thus with margin management and liquidity risk tied to this, are there kind of unintended consequences that you guys think are going to become only increasingly important or obvious in, say, the next 12 to 18 months, and something that our listeners here should be well aware of?
Well, one thing that I would say is that, first of all, it's good to hear you talk about unintended consequences, because that's a theme that I've been sort of pounding on for, since 2009 when this started to be a pretty evident that this was going to be the direction in which regulators and legislators were going to move. And I think that there are going to be unintended consequences in, quote, normal times, and then also particularly in abnormal or stress times. And I think that the most serious unintended consequences could occur during times of market stress. And as Ed has noted, this is going to have widespread ramifications for all aspects of derivatives trading, pricing, financing, funding, and so on, and just how these new institutions are going to perform in a stress situation remains to be seen. And I think that particularly one potentially important and crucial area of vulnerability where we won't really know how it works until we see it actually be tested is how these funding and liquidity mechanisms are going to work during times of market stress and big moves and where not only initial margin is an issue, but also big variation margin flows.
And Ed, is there any unintended consequences that keep you awake at night?
I wouldn't say I call them unintended consequences. I think there are implications from central clearing, and I suppose as much as anything, we're spending a lot of time trying to, think through what those might be and educate our clients. I guess the biggest, issue that I think will, persist is the transitional one. So if we, as we move through this sort of process over the coming sort of 2 or 3 years, we've already seen a relatively significant move in central clearing from some buy side and, you know, equally from dealers, a big increase in the use of central clearing to mitigate direct bilateral counterparty risk recently. I guess that's fine for those bigger institutions. My concern is making sure that, you know, we understand that there are, you know, potentially thousands of participants in the market that would need to move into these models, and just the relative readiness of some of those participants is pretty broad. So let's say what I call the compliance angle to this is going to be quite challenging. In other words, making sure that everything is done as the regulators want it to be done by every market participant. And I think it's probably going to be beholden on us as a larger institution to make sure that we're operating against all of those requirements. But I fear for some of the smaller firms that, you know, perhaps need a lot more support. And, you know, we are trying to get around to everyone we can, but there's a lot of work to be done still to get this thing up and running and make it fully operational. To the point of, you know, how these things will operate in a stressed market condition, we've obviously seen a Lehman default that was handled extremely well by the LCH, and we're living through a new default at the moment. It's very current, and we'll have to wait and see how that's dealt with. But, you know, there are other products out there, you know, in addition to OTC, we see repo being cleared and the LCH providing some great liquidity in the repo market, certainly in Europe, and we're going through that default at the moment. So, you know, let's see what happens and how that transpires. But generally speaking, central clearing has performed well. As we expand it to a broader range of market participants, we've got to be absolutely certain that the regulators have done their job in making sure that they've, you know, that the standards they've set around these central clearing counterparties are sufficiently robust.
That's great. I want to actually focus a little bit more on some of the points that you mentioned just now, Ed, and drilling down into some of the operational costs as firms will have to invest in their operations and rely on their service providers to help them meet this heavy compliance burden. Can you walk us through some of the major operational costs or investments that you think are required by banks such as yourself, obviously, but also potentially your clients to do the connectivity and all the other kind of margin requirements and management that's required in this new environment?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the first thing to say is that, you know, it really is only the larger intermediaries at the moment that have, you know, moved early enough and have invested the money that's required to make this work. It is a technology challenge from the dealer's perspective or clearing broker's firm to be able to handle some of these solutions. But from a client perspective, I think there's really sort of two or three main areas to focus on. And the costs, you know, may be broader for some clients, but relatively speaking for others may not be as big. And what I mean by that is if electronic confirmation is already, you know, being used and understood, if the client's already put in place bilateral CSAs for their OTC swaps and as a result is exchanging daily collateral, and if the client has been engaged in discussions either with clearinghouses or dealers around how the legal model will work, then some of the transitional costs may be not as great as people might fear. I think from an operational perspective, there will be some changes to the way that collateral is now obviously called margin is settled and the requirements around that. But some of those things, if the client is, for instance, using listed derivatives and clearing those today, they may find some of those processes quite familiar, and it will just be a question of, do we need to change our operating model around the way that we handle the post-trade parts of the process flow. There's obviously a little bit that will be required in terms of dealing. We haven't talked yet about the electronic trading requirements in the US and potential electronic trading requirements in Europe. Those are something that at this stage, you know, there are electronic trading platforms already out there, and if clients, again, are using them today, then those transitional costs may not be as great. But if all of these things are new to a client, so they don't have electronic confirmation, they don't have two-way CSAs, they aren't doing electronic trading, they aren't familiar with the legal models that are being proposed, maybe they don't even trade futures, then obviously, you know, those are the areas that I think people would find the most cost coming from. But I think I'll make one point, which Craig alluded to at the start as well. You know, the big financial intermediaries like ourselves kind of taken it upon themselves to provide, we call almost an insulation layer to all of the different offerings that are out there, the different legal models, and the different timings around collateral and requirements to try and make it as, you know, seamless as possible for the client to access these models. It's really our job to do that. That's what the clients are asking for, so that we become the one-stop shop across all of the clearinghouses and all of the markets that they're operating in. And that obviously drives the cost for us.
Thank you, Ed. And Craig, I don't know if there's something that you'd like to add about operational costs, because you deal with so many different types of financial institutions. Is there a major concern that you've heard a lot of in the market?
I'll just point out, you know, sort of one sort of irony in what Ed just said, which is exactly right, which is that if you listen to a lot of regulators, particularly in the U.S., like CFTC head Gary Gensler, he's promoting central clearing mandates as being a way of reducing interconnectivity amongst big financial institutions and as a way of essentially reducing their importance. And this might be one of those unintended consequences. They're the natural providers of the services that are needed to make clearing work for most customers. And so I think it's this is an illustration of one of those unintended consequences that we talked about, is that it's just going to sort of reconfigure the topology of the network and not really reduce its degree of interconnectivity.
Perfect. Now, one of the questions that I'm getting a lot is looking in the long term, how firms are supposed to deal with all these costs, you know, risk as well as margin, operational, et cetera. So what do you think the true long-term impact will be on the market? I know this is the million-dollar question here, really, but is there something that you, either of you, want to add in terms of what you foresee the next 12 months to look like and what, you know, it's truly going to impact the market in terms of cost going forward?
In some respects, that's going to be dependent on you know, the regulators and how the regulators move. I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned 12 months, because you know, that's typically how the regulators in the U.S. have extended the timeline. And so I think a lot of the pieces that are going to be needed to really see where things are going still remain to be completed, and that's in particular some of the, you know, some of the regulations and the regulatory process here in the U.S. and Europe is also just getting started there. So I think that you know, that's an element of uncertainty that will really affect how things play out over the next 12, 24 months.
And Ed, are there any predictions that you want to offer or last-minute insight?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I share Craig's sort of views on timeline. I think this is something that's going to run and run. I do think, though, that, you know, one of the things I think that may happen is that the market may move ahead of regulation. And we're already seeing that. So some people are using central clearing to mitigate certain counterparty risks. I think that that's a theme that, you know, may continue in the current market turmoil that we're seeing. I think obviously the events of the last few weeks are going to raise, you know, a new set of questions potentially around how people are protected and is it, you know, what type of protection do they receive over their assets in different jurisdictions. And that will be another sort of aspect of all of this, which I think will continue. I suppose in terms of the regulatory uncertainty, I think the general themes and objectives are pretty well understood, but people may be facing the prospect now as they plan for next year of a project that is going to have to be based on a series of assumptions, and those assumptions will need to either be sort of realized and proven or, you know, let's say changes to some things that people may implement may be required. The big challenge, I think, which we haven't talked about that, you know, I get questions on every day are really around how do we deal with the cross-border issues, and really transatlantic issues is probably the best way to describe them. We obviously have our own views on how that will pan out, but I think that's going to be a big headache for a number of particularly European firms that, let's say, have got money in the US or being managed by a US manager and so on. I mean, those kind of things really need lots of quite clear guidance, I think, or clearer guidance than what we've got today. And that, I think, is probably going to be one of the things that will continue as people try to just make sure that the business models they've established today can continue in the new world, if you can call it that.
Okay, great. Well, thank you to Craig Perrong and Ed Allen for sharing their insight with us on this timely topic. As Ed and Craig have both pointed out today, this is an ongoing discussion and something that is going to develop over the next year, if not longer, so do stay tuned. If you do have any questions on this topic or for either speaker, you're welcome to submit comments or questions in the comments section at the bottom of the webpage. So please feel free to do so, and we'll aim to address your questions if appropriate, really. So thank you for tuning into our podcast, and again, thanks to Craig and Ed for joining us today.
Thank you.